Day proclaiming April 3rd through 9th, 2023 as National Public Health Week. Do we have Dr. Berry?
Veronica.
Oh, great. And Veronica's been brought over. Welcome, Veronica. Glad you're with us. So we will go ahead and read through the proclamation and then we'll take some comments from hopefully Dr. Berry and Veronica. All right. Why don't we, we'll reverse it and I'll go first and then Heidi, then Kate. Sound good?
Yep.
All right. Proclamation. Whereas during the month of April, Jefferson County honors National Public Health Week, April 3rd through 9th, 2023. And
whereas each year for National Public Health Week, Jefferson County Public Health and the Jefferson County Board of Health honor people and organizations who make a significant contribution to maintaining and improving health in Jefferson County. And
whereas public health professionals help communities prevent, prepare for, mitigate, and recover from the impact of a full range of health threats, including disease outbreaks, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, natural disasters, such as wildfires, flooding, and severe storms, and other disasters, including disasters caused by human activity and public health emergencies. And
whereas public health professionals collaborate with partners outside of the health sector, including city planners, transportation officials, education officials, and private sector businesses, recognizing that other sectors can influence health outcomes. And
whereas Jefferson County Public Health began recognizing public health heroes as a way to celebrate National Public Health Week locally by honoring people who live or work in Jefferson County and who promote public health in their daily lives. And
whereas a public health hero is a person or an organization that promotes public health in daily life. Each day of Public Health Week has a different public health focus, and nominations can relate to any of the public health focus areas, but are open to others as well. And
whereas the following are the public health focus areas for Public Health Week 2023: community, violence prevention, reproductive and sexual health, mental health, rural health accessibility, and food and nutrition.
Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Jefferson County Commissioners do hereby proclaim April 3rd to the 9th, 2023, as National Public Health Week in Jefferson County, and encourage people in this county to join us in this special observance. Proclaim this third day of April, 2023.
Love it. I'd welcome a motion before we...
I would move that we approve this proclamation.
I will second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded that we approve the proclamation proclaiming the week of April 3rd through 9th, 2023 as National Public Health Week. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Great. So now this is, of course, as big as the last one. We just honored our volunteers in another proclamation, but public health is it's a big umbrella. Dr. Berry, do you have any words you want to say about this?
Sure. Thank you so much for declaring Public Health Week. We really appreciate it. I think one of the critical things about public health is it is it affects the health of all of us. It is the driver of all of our health. And I think particularly in the last few years, what we've seen is that all of our health is interconnected. We are all healthier when we are focusing on the health of ourselves and of our neighbors. I think that's the critical difference between public health and health care, is that it's not just individualized, but it's realizing that we are a community and we all succeed better together. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic really showed us that. But public health is so much more than infectious diseases. It's our built environment. It's whether or not we have access to the critical needs to live a healthy life. And I really like that in Public Health Week, we're looking at our public health heroes outside of our department, and the many people in our community who work together to make this a healthier place for all of us.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Berry. And Veronica, can you say a few words about this proclamation?
Sure. I just want to mention that this year we will be awarding 12 local businesses and also nonprofits and individuals. So that says a lot. We have many people in our community engaged, and I think the pandemic did a lot, as far as engaging locals in public health, and it made our relationship with them stronger. And so I look forward to this year, moving forward again in a positive direction building those relationships even more. And this is just another step in that direction.
Great.
Since we've alluded to the heroes, should we share who they are? I'm happy to pull up a.
Yeah, let's list them. I think that'd be a great way to begin to honor them for their work in the community.
Let's see, here they are. Jumping Mass Children's Center, of course, does counseling for youth. Benji Project, mental health nonprofit, working primarily with teens. Cameron Botkin is a youth coach, also works in the Chimacum schools. Tanya Burkett does diversity, equity, and inclusion training with a number of organizations locally. Greg Graves, wonderful volunteer with the Parks and Rec Advisory Board for many years. Charlie Johnson, is anyone able to speak to Charlie? I think he's the only one I don't know personally. JC Mash, free clinic, of course, providing free medical care for a number of people, but especially our most vulnerable and homeless populations. The Jump Board, who made the playground happen. Judith Lundgren, who has hosted a number of fundraising events for various nonprofit organizations at the Hilltop Tavern all these years at Barstool Bingo. Shannon Minahan, incredible food service, farm to school, work in the cafeterias in Port Townsend School District. Bo Olgren, a wonderful advocate for youth and particularly trans youth. And Mark Serrano, counselor, also working primarily with youth on mental health in this community. Veronica, do you happen to know Charlie Johnson?
Yes, a local firefighter paramedic with East Jefferson Fire and Rescue. Just definitely goes above and beyond his normal duties and responsibilities.
Wonderful.
Great.
We thank them all and honor them.
I feel like we need ticker taper.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah. Well, we'll have another celebration of all these folks as we present them with awards. And are we actually doing it in person this year?
At too, the right? Board of Health meeting.
Board of Health meeting on the what? Find that day here. 13th? No. On April 20th at
2:30. Great.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Veronica. Thank you, Dr. Barry, for speaking to that. And I'll just say, you know, this job changes the way you look at a lot of things. And I've widened my focus in looking at health issues and looking at the landscape of public health, you know, whether it's these environmental or built conditions or infectious diseases. Looking at widening the focus really illuminates a lot of the trees. So you can actually see the trees better sometimes if you look at the whole forest.
Yeah, and that idea that you're zip code determines your health as much as your genetic code does these days, because the way that we build our communities very much affects the health of us and our neighbors. So love the public health lens.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Veronica. And we'll just continue in this vein. And thank you to the listeners of KPTZ for walking through this with us. And we'll pass it over to Dr. Barry for our monthly update now.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here. And as Commissioner Brotherton noted, this is a transition presentation where we are transitioning to how we'll handle these presentations as we move into this next phase of the pandemic. We are moving into a different time in the pandemic. When I think back to where we were when this all started, when we were tracking every individual case that was coming in and we were really trying to shut down transmission, before we had vaccines, before we had effective treatments, we really have come a long way. And so in acknowledgement of that, an acknowledgement of this this new phase that we are in, where we are facing a different threat when it comes to this virus, we are going to be decreasing the frequency of these updates a little bit. We're going to be doing these once a month. I do still plan to be here once a month to answer questions related to COVID-19, but we can also look at other public health related issues that we might want to talk about on the BOCC and KPTZ. So the first Monday of every month I'll be here, and so you can still send in questions to KPTZ. We had a lot of great questions this month that we'll tackle a little bit later. The other major transition we are making at the department is we're changing how we are reporting numbers. And that's primarily because we're reaching a point in the pandemic where pure case counting is just not as possible as it was before. With the transition to home tests, with less people testing and less people reporting their cases, it's really incredibly difficult to actually get an accurate count of how many cases are out there. We are moving towards what we generally refer to in epidemiology is what's called sentinel surveillance. That sentinel surveillance system isn't entirely built at the state level yet to track COVID-19, but we're moving in that direction. And in the meantime, at Jefferson County Public Health, what we're going to be doing is reporting the state numbers directly onto our website. And I did check this morning before I joined you all, and they are there. So if you go to the case information section of the COVID-19 site, you'll see them there. Primarily because we're having an increasing challenge tracking individual cases, the biggest numbers that we look at are the ones that we know are accurate. So looking at cases of severe disease, looking at people who are hospitalized for COVID-19, and also looking at the number of people who have died due to COVID-19 in our region. Those are numbers we know are accurate. Case information is much more difficult to assess at this time. And looking at those numbers, by and large, the story looks good. It looks like it's improving nationally. The New York Times, which has been tracking cases with us this whole time, also changed the way that they report data this week as well. So we're in good company. Looking at the national picture, about 5,000 people are currently hospitalized for COVID-19, and the number of people dying due to COVID-19 is also decreasing. Currently, we're seeing 228 deaths due to COVID-19 per day in the United States. That's still about four times what you would see during a bad flu season, but it is much better than we have seen at earlier phases in the pandemic. And it's a hopeful sign. That's a significant reduction from where we were just 2 weeks ago in the United States. And so I'm hopeful that we are moving into better days. At the state level, we are seeing a similar trend in hospitalization and death. In Jefferson County, we also are not seeing a spike in severe disease. We have no one currently hospitalized for COVID-19, and we have no new deaths to report. So we've seen a total of 36 deaths in Jefferson County so far in this response. In neighboring Clallam County, we do have two individuals currently hospitalized for COVID-19, and we have no new deaths to report for a total of 166 deaths in Clallam County. When we look at our case rates, at least what we can see at the state level, the case rate is 134 per 100,000 in Jefferson County, but the state has a case ascertainment rate of about 1 in 20. And so what we're seeing there is that persistently high rate of transmission. There's still a lot of COVID-19 out there in the community, but we're just not seeing a significant surge in severe disease. And we do think that is primarily driven by the amount of population immunity we are seeing, particularly the number of people who are up to date on their vaccines. In Clallam County, our case rate is listed as 80 per 100,000 with the same case ascertainment rate. The other big change that is happening right now is today is the lifting of the state mask mandate for healthcare facilities. But I would probably better to describe that as a transition to more normal modes of operation. So we're moving out of the phase of emergency government mandates and moving towards what in medicine we call standard of care. In medicine, we have had standard of care since the beginning, and it's how we discuss the normal way that we deliver care to protect our patients. That includes having high quality medical training, delivering efficacious treatments. It also includes what's called infection prevention. So all the steps that we take as your medical care providers to not give you infections when you come to see us. So that's why you see your medical provider wash their hands numerous times throughout the day. And that's also why in most settings, you're still going to see your medical provider wearing a mask when they see you. That's because we know that masks work incredibly well at reducing the risk of giving and getting COVID-19. And we have a special obligation as medical providers to not infect our patients when they come to see us. Our patients are by definition more vulnerable than the general population because that's why they're there, and they are more likely to be sick. So in most healthcare settings, you're still going to see your medical providers wearing a mask. I do want to acknowledge that some individuals in our community struggle to hear when their provider has a mask. And in those kind of settings, it's okay to ask your provider to briefly take down the mask to explain something to you and to put it back on, and look at other environmental modifications as needed to make sure that you can understand what your provider is saying to you. We've always been able to adjust masking to take care of our patients. And I think now is the time to make sure that we're being nuanced and thoughtful in how we interact with our patients. But most of us will still be masking going forward as we assess whether or not COVID-19 is going to move into a seasonal pattern like influenza and RSV, or if it's going to be with us in a more long-term way. Currently, with the decrease in severe disease that we're seeing in the numbers that we can track, in the decreased number of people even just showing up at the hospital who are incidentally found to be positive for COVID-19, that does suggest that we may be moving into more of a seasonal pattern with this virus, but it remains to be seen whether or not that will be sustained. So that's the major update when it comes to COVID-19. I know we have a lot of excellent questions from KPTZ, but I wanted to take any questions from our commissioners first.
Questions for Dr. Berry?
Nope.
I guess I appreciate the changing ways that we're measuring this, moving to sentinel surveillance. And I guess I've asked you this question before. Is it still a pandemic? Is it just that we have an awkward noun for endemic, but are we in the endemic phase now? When do we turn the page?
Sure. So I do think we are in the endemic phase. Endemic and pandemic are not necessarily antithetical to each other. Endemic is just means that something is with us now. It is more of a norm. So for instance, in some parts of the world, there are infectious diseases that are endemic, and that's the term that we use to mean something that is a part of there. So malaria is endemic to certain parts of the world, but not to other parts. I think we are, it's accurate to say we're moving into a new phase. But the big question when it comes to COVID-19 is it going to be persistently endemic? Is it going to continue to circulate at these high levels that we're seeing right now? Or is it going to fall off and become seasonal like the flu? And that we don't know for sure yet. We'll know a lot more in the next few months. But it is with us now. And it's a part of, I think, one of the challenges we see is that there's a desire to move back to the days before COVID. But there is no moving to a time where COVID isn't here now. It's a change from our prior lives. We used to live in a world where there wasn't COVID. Now we live in a world where there is. So our behavior has to change to match that. And that doesn't mean we consistently live at emergency pandemic levels. We can't sustain that. But it does mean that some of our behavior is different now than it was 3 years ago, because there's a new virus around that is very dangerous for particularly some members of our community. There are people who are immunosuppressed in our community, people who are very elderly and very sick, or very, very young. So newborn babies are also high risk from COVID-19. And there's a lot we need to do to protect them because this virus is here and it's still circulating and it's not gone. But we don't have to live at the emergency levels now. So one of the things that we used to do was decide masking based on how much COVID-19 was around. Well, now we know it's around. It's not gone. It's not going away anytime soon. So how do we live with it? How do we live meaningful lives that protect the most vulnerable in our community without living in a consistent state of emergency? And so one of the things that we changed is how we recommend masking. We used to recommend masking based on that dial. So when we were at high levels of transmission, you could mask. When we got to low levels of transmission, which we sometimes did back when we had intensive medication, you could unmask. But now it's a little bit more nuanced. You wear a mask if you're feeling sick or if you're around people who are sick. You wear a mask if you are high risk yourself or if you're caring for someone who is very high risk, particularly someone who's immunosuppressed. People who are receiving cancer therapy are some of the highest risk for COVID-19, or people who are persistently immunosuppressed because of a medical condition. If you have those folks in your household, you want to exercise more caution. And then particularly, you also want to look at where you are. So are you indoors? Is it very crowded? Is there poor ventilation? That's a time where it makes sense to put a mask on, particularly if you or someone in your household is high risk. So for myself and my family, my rough assessment is, are there 20 people in this room? And is it a poorly ventilated space? then I'm generally going to put a mask on. When I see patients, because those folks are sick, I put a mask on. So when you see me in clinical care, you're going to see me with a mask on because of the folks who are coming to see me. That's how I make those decisions, and that's how we recommend all of us make decisions. There are places where you can unmask. If you're having a nice, you know, five neighbors over for a dinner or a card game, I think it's reasonable to unmask, but it depends on your risk and the people in your house, how comfortable you are taking those risks.
Thank you. I think we should dig into the listener questions.
All right. So speaking of masks, that's probably a good transition to one of the questions we got. So this this listener asked, is it considered safe now to attend church, go to bars, theaters, or book clubs, et cetera, without a mask? And I wish I could tell you a pure safe, not safe, but it's a lot more complex than that, and it's a lot more nuanced. And so it depends on your health condition. What is your health status? What is the health status of the other people in your house? Particularly if you are up to date on your vaccines, the most critical one is, what is your health status? Because we know the people who are up to date on their vaccines are less likely to pre-symptomatically shed COVID. So you have a better shot at not giving it to your household if you get COVID-19 now, as long as you pay attention to your body and test as soon as you develop any kind of symptoms. So if you look at your own health status, say you're, you know, in your 40s, doing pretty well, don't have a lot of medical conditions, it's reasonable to take some more risks. But if you are 75, have heart failure, severe lung disease, it's reasonable to be a little bit more cautious. You want to look at your own health status, and you want to look at the space that you're entering. So are you going into a coffee shop that has a few people who are well spaced out, they've got the windows open? That's pretty safe. If you're going to a bookstore downtown, there's just a few other people there at any given time, that's pretty safe. But if you're going to a crowded indoor church where there's 200 people right next to each other and they don't have windows open, they don't have a lot of filters, that's a higher risk space. You're generally in a church for an hour or more, depending on the way that you worship. So that's a space for myself that I would wear a mask. So it depends on the environment that you're going into, your health status, and definitely if you're feeling a little ill, that's a really good time to make sure that you have a mask on. So we have to make decisions in a little bit more nuanced way, but are you sick? Are you taking care of people who are sick? Are you high risk yourself? And is it very crowded? Are there lots of people and poor ventilation? In those spaces, I would definitely recommend wearing a mask still. Another good set of questions. We had a couple different questions about getting an additional bivalent booster. So one listener noticed that in Canada, they have now recommended an additional bivalent booster for those who are particularly high risk from COVID-19, those who are very elderly, who have underlying chronic conditions, and those who are immunosuppressed. That is not the recommendation yet in the United States, but I do say yet because just in the last couple of weeks, at least in neighboring Clallam County, we have started to see severe disease crop up again in some of our most high-risk individuals, particularly in those who are living in long-term care facilities. We know individuals who live in long-term care are particularly high risk for COVID-19. They tend to be quite elderly and quite sick. That's why they're there. And they're living in a congregate space. So it's much more common for COVID-19 to transmit in those kind of congregate spaces. And for the first time since the bivalents came out, we are starting to see individual cases of severe disease, even in those high-risk elders who have gotten their bivalent. They're still much less common than in people who have not gotten their bivalent, but it used to be we just never saw it. If you've gotten your bivalent, I knew you weren't going to get severely ill. And we've just started to see that crop up in the last couple of weeks, which makes me concerned. Technically, the additional bivalent is not approved yet for use in the United States. And so it's not something you can go ask your doctor for right now because they can't give you an additional bivalent until the FDA and the CDC move forward with that recommendation. But I do hope that they move forward with that recommendation to make it available for those who are at highest risk. We don't recommend an additional bivalent for the general population. most of us don't need another bivalent, but I do think it would make sense to make another vaccine at least available for those who are highest risk who want it. And I don't know yet if and when the federal government is going to move forward with that, but I hope they do. And we are encouraging the states and our federal colleagues to move forward with making that option available to our highest risk elders, because we're starting to see that rise in severe disease. Now, the reason why they haven't made that recommendation yet is because this is small numbers. We haven't seen, you know, large scale data that would show that. But what I don't want to see is a lot of people get severely ill before we make that recommendation. So we have to make these decisions on the earlier end. So what does that mean for you? If you are in a high risk group, or someone in your family is in a high risk group, and you don't have an additional vaccine available to you, that can be a really scary spot. I do want to acknowledge that the vast majority of folks who've gotten their bivalent are very well protected. We've only seen this in the long-term care setting at this point. We haven't seen it in the general population. And so I do think most of us are still very, very well protected with our bivalent, and we have other things available to us. So if you are high risk, or someone in your household is high risk, we have masking available to us. We have Paxlovid available to us. When we look at the cases in Clallam that got severe disease in spite of their vaccine status, all of them didn't get Paxlovid. And so you want to make sure that if you're high risk, or someone in your family is high risk, if you get sick, you want to test right away. The free tests are still available. And you want to access Paxlovid if you test positive, because it's really critical for our highest risk individuals to maintain that protection against severe disease. The state telehealth line is still available through early June, and so that's a good option if you can't get in quickly with your primary care provider. We have to layer our protections for the most vulnerable in our society, but when we do that, we see that folks generally do fine. So if you've gotten your bivalent, you're very well protected. But if you're in that highest risk group, or someone in your household is, you want to make sure and use the other methods we have available until or unless the state and the feds go ahead and recommend an additional bivalent for you. Another question asked a lot about treatments for COVID-19. And particularly asked about this concept of safe and effective. You hear it thrown around a lot. And how do we compare the different treatments that are available for COVID-19? So we are in a much better place than we were at the beginning of the pandemic, when we had no treatments at all for COVID-19. And many, many different treatments have been studied since that time to look for their safety and efficacy. When we look at medical treatments, it needs to meet both bars. So it needs to be safe. It can't be something that's dangerous for you to take. And it needs to be effective. It needs to make you less likely to get severe disease or die due to that infection, or maybe even less likely to get it at all. So when we look at treatments, those are for folks who we know already have the disease. Vaccination is for preventing the disease and preventing severe outcomes from the disease. Looking at the various treatments we have for COVID-19, we have two treatments currently that are recommended for those who are at risk of severe disease when they develop infection, but they're not severe yet, they're not in the hospital, and that's Paxlovid and Molnupiravir. Paxlovid is very safe, very low risk of severe outcomes related to the medication itself. We have a lot of experience using it now, and we've seen very, very few side effects related to Paxlovid. The most common is actually a change in your sense of taste. People describe a metallic taste in their mouth. But it's very effective. So it's a 76% reduction in the risk of death from COVID-19 in high-risk individuals who get Paxlovid. So it's a very good drug, and it's very safe. Molnupiravir, less effective, still improved, better than nothing. So molnupiravir is what we recommend if people can't get Paxlovid. That shows a 25% reduction in death from COVID-19. So it's still something for people who can't get Paxlovid, who have a contraindication. The next set of ones that are recommended and that have been approved in the United States are for those who are actually already very severely ill. So people who are already in the hospital, what do we do once you get to the hospital? And really a game changer when it comes to COVID-19 has been dexamethasone. Dexamethasone reduces your risk of death from COVID-19 for people who are already in the hospital about 40%. It's also very safe. It does raise blood sugar. So for people who are diabetic, that's something we need to monitor in the hospital, but we're very good at doing that in the hospital. It's a very safe medication. Remdesivir is an antiviral medication that we use for people who are hospitalized. It's been shown to reduce the risk of death from COVID-19 on the order of about 20%, so not as good as dexamethasone, but we've used it because it does reduce your risk of death. And it is a very safe medication. There's a common among folks who are kind of who are hesitant about vaccines and medical interventions for COVID. You might see on the internet a lot of concerns about risk of kidney or liver damage related to remdesivir, or risk of cardiac issues related to remdesivir. And when we actually parse that out, when we look at patients, the primary driver of all of those bad outcomes was actually the COVID-19 infection itself. So we know that COVID-19 leads to full body inflammation, cardiac inflammation, inflammation of your other organs, can lead to kidney failure, liver failure, all of these other things. And there was the problem with causation and correlation. People saw that people were hospitalized for COVID-19 and then went into multi-organ failure, and they blamed the treatments. But it was actually the COVID-19 itself. When you look at patients who were hospitalized, they did a large study looking at VA patients who went in, who actually got remdesivir or didn't. Those who got remdesivir were no more likely to experience these multi-organ failures. In fact, they were much less likely because we were controlling the COVID-19, which is what was driving that organ failure. But that was where some of that confusion came from. This listener particularly asked about hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. You know, why aren't we talking about those? Hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin have been around for a long time. They have actually a pretty good safety profile. So they meet the safety measure as long as they're delivered in a medical setting by a provider who's dosing them appropriately. But what they don't meet, unfortunately, is the efficacy bar. So there have been multiple large randomized control trials because many of those in the medical community actually were really excited about these drugs. They were really hopeful they would be effective at treating COVID-19. So they've done multiple large randomized controlled trials looking at these. And unfortunately, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin just didn't meet that bar. They were no more effective than a placebo at reducing severity disease from COVID-19. So while they are generally safe in a medical context, they just aren't effective. And so we don't recommend people taking something that has a small risk of side effects and which is no better than a placebo at reducing your risk of severe disease. If you do have another medical indication for these, there are other medical indications for these. In a medical setting, they can be done well. What we saw especially in Clallam County earlier in the pandemic, was individuals who were nervous about accessing standard medical care who were accessing these medications on their own. And that does carry significant risk. Ivermectin, inappropriately dosed, can lead to liver failure. And we did see at least one case of that in Clallam County. So you want to make sure if you're taking medications, you're doing that under medical supervision. Incorrectly dosed medications can be dangerous. And we did see that start to happen with ivermectin. The other thing that can happen is it can delay your access to appropriate medical care. So we saw individuals who weren't accessing Paxlovid and dexamethasone and the things that we know work for COVID-19. They were just staying home taking hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, not other medical care. And so that delay in access to medical care did lead to worse outcomes for them. Moral of the story, we have many more treatments available, and we definitely recommend engaging in medical treatment in the context of medical care. It can seem tempting. There's a lot of understandable reasons where people are hesitant to access the medical system. But I can tell you, I've worked with the folks at Jefferson Healthcare very closely. They're very dedicated to providing excellent care to the individuals in our community. It's a safe place to go. And it's much more safe than trying to dose your meds on your own. A couple other good questions came in. Let's see. One other one was asking about the context of number needed to treat when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines. There's a lot of different ways that we look at the effectiveness of interventions. One that we use usually when it comes to actually medicines that we're prescribing, when we think of things like statins or blood pressure medications, is the number needed to treat. That is, how many people we need to give a certain intervention to prevent a designated outcome. So like death from a heart attack when we're talking about heart medications. Generally, number needed to treat is something that we look at for something that's given over a long period of time and that has a long period of follow-up. So when we look at number needed to treat when it comes to cardiac interventions, that's usually done over a 5 or 10 year follow-up period. When we look at cancer therapies, same thing, 5 or 10 year survival rates for those. Number needed to treat is not very commonly applied to things with a short follow-up period. And so for those, especially for some folks who are hesitant about vaccines, there's been some circulating on the internet of why aren't we talking about number needed to treat when it comes to vaccines? The primary reason for that is actually follow-up time, is that we just don't have enough follow-up time to get that metric. But we do actually have number needed to treat for the initial COVID-19 vaccines. So getting vaccinated at all, the number needed to treat to prevent a death from COVID-19 in the general population is 81, which is pretty good. Getting 80 people vaccinated to keep one of us from dying, that's a pretty good metric when it comes to a medical intervention, particularly when you're talking about something that's as safe as vaccines. We don't have that number yet for the bivalent vaccines, which is what this listener was asking about, because it's just too short. We just don't have enough follow-up time to have seen some of those outcomes that we want to see. But what we do get good data on is relative risk reduction. And we also have real-world data now on the efficacy of the bivalent vaccines. So one of the, and as well as the vaccines as a whole, one very compelling study was out of the Cleveland Clinic, and they looked at hospitalizations for COVID-19 over the course of 2021. And when they looked at all of the people hospitalized due to COVID-19, 99% of them were not up to date on their vaccines. So we do have real world data on that. And since the bivalent came out in our region until just about 2 weeks ago, whenever we saw someone hospitalized for COVID-19, they had never gotten their bivalent. And particularly even when we're talking about our highest risk individuals. So that's a lot of the data that we look at. We also see that there's a study that just came out in 2023 that showed a 60% overall risk reduction of severe disease if you've gotten your bivalent. And that's actually for everybody, not just for those who are 65 and older. That's for 18 and up as well. It's a worthwhile intervention. It's worth getting. So a lot of detailed and somewhat technical questions this week. And so hopefully it was still of interest for those who didn't ask the questions. But I think the overall story there is that we now have a lot more data than we did at the beginning of the pandemic. And consistently what we're seeing is the vaccines continue to be safe. These are some of the most carefully monitored and studied vaccines that we've ever had. And they've also been given to a larger number of people over a longer period of time than the other vaccines that we have. So we know that they're safe. Adverse outcomes are incredibly rare. The most common adverse outcome that you'll get is a fever, which is usually short-lived. The severe adverse outcomes are incredibly uncommon, and the efficacy is incredibly clear. Being up to date on your vaccines is critical to reduce your risk of severe disease from COVID and to reduce your risk of getting and giving COVID-19 to others. We also thankfully have far more treatments available than we have before. We are starting to see a little bit of a concerning sign about reduction in protection for those at highest risk in our community from their bivalent, which is why it's so important to use the other methods we have available to reduce your risk of getting COVID-19 and treating it quickly under medical supervision if you develop COVID-19. And I saw there was a very interesting question for Willie, which I'm happy to help out with if you'd like.
Yeah, I was... maybe had an answer for that too, but any last follow-ups for Dr. Berry before we pass it over to Willie?
Nope.
Maybe real quick, Dr. Berry, And I'm sorry if you mentioned this, but are you able to speak to how Jefferson Healthcare plans to respond to the end of the mask mandate, other than you said providers will likely continue to wear them, but in terms of patients, do you know?
Good question. So I have spoken with Jefferson Healthcare as well as all of the hospital systems in our region. And Jefferson Healthcare will continue to require masking for medical care providers, so your nurses, your doctors, when they're going to be seeing you providing patient care. Masks will no longer be required for patients in most areas. They are still recommended. When you think of, for instance, sitting in a waiting room with other folks who might be there because they have COVID-19, I would strongly recommend wearing a mask there, but it won't be required for patients in those spaces. There will likely be some higher risk areas, and I know some of that conversation is still ongoing at Jefferson Healthcare, where masks will be required, particularly around some of our sickest patients. So I know at Olympic Medical Center, for instance, in Clallam County, when you go into the ICU, you still have to wear a mask as a visitor, because kind of by definition, everyone around you is very high risk in the ICU, and we want to take extra special care with them. And many health systems are also still requiring masking of visitors in oncology centers, because we know that those who are accessing cancer care are particularly high risk. I don't know the final decision about that for Jefferson Healthcare, but I anticipate they'll be putting out some messaging quite soon.
Well, and I mentioned before you got on the call that I traveled to a conference last week and masked extensively, and the colleague that I was there with got very sick, just a bad cold, but I was very pleased that I did not. So I'm feeling very grateful for masks today.
Yeah, that's the nice thing. It's nice to not get colds, nice to not get the flu and all the other things. Masks are a really powerful intervention for reducing your risk of getting sick. They're worthwhile to use in spaces where it's possible to do it.
All right. Great. Well, we will thank you very much, Dr. Barry. We'll turn it over to Willie since he has a question and lay it on us, Willie.
I know, very exciting. I don't know how many weeks or months it had been since I had a question. I was excited to see it. I appreciate your assistance in helping answer it, Dr. Barry. I'll do my best and then I'll let you correct me with whatever needs to be corrected. But this week's KPTZ question for me concerned CO2, carbon dioxide concentration levels, and what's safe on an ongoing basis. We've talked a lot at this meeting about CO2 concentration levels being a good proxy for airflow and how well ventilated the room is, as a mitigation against the spread of COVID-19, since we often see less COVID-19 transmission outdoors and in these well-ventilated spaces. So this individual bought a CO2 monitor, wanted to know what's an acceptable exposure level over prolonged periods in their home. And so outdoors, we usually see a concentration of about 400 parts per million. And then that goes up once we move indoors, and we're not as well-ventilated as we are outside. Typically anywhere between 400 to 1,000 is considered safe indoors. And once you get to that 1,000 level, things don't become unsafe, but that's when we start considering rooms maybe more stuffy, less well-ventilated, and we may start seeing some ill effects over long periods of time. At about 1,000 parts per million and above, that's when we see folks maybe becoming a little bit sleepy due to poor ventilation and airflow there. 2,000 parts per million, that's when we start seeing potential folks being a little more lethargic, folks potentially getting headaches or feeling nauseous, again, over long periods of exposure. And then 5,000 parts per million, that's the occupational safety limit, and that may be indicative of something else going wrong, other toxic gases or fumes within the room. So within your home, anywhere between 400 and 1,000 parts per million, totally within the realm of acceptability. Shorter term exposures to more, completely and totally fine. For example, in the New York City subway, when they measured CO2 there, they were at 2,400 parts per million. So again, long-term exposure, we may see some ill effects, but for the most part, almost everyone is gonna be okay at that level of concentration. Some public health departments I had seen across the country recommended once you reach that 800 parts per million threshold, you should consider a HEPA air filter to help clean the air within the space to prevent COVID transmission. But at that level, just within the confines of your own home, you're going to be totally okay, no ill effects through that CO2 concentration. We do have a CO2 device here in the EOC. We were at 470 parts per million as of just about 5 minutes ago. So not totally quite at outdoor levels of fresh air, but just a little bit of an uptick. But credit to our facilities team for keeping good air circulation in the bunker here at the EOC. This individual did note that when they bought their CO2 monitor, it first read at about 10,000 parts per million. There definitely is something wrong. It needs to be reset, recalibrated, or returned. That is at pretty toxic levels of CO2 concentration. Definitely considered getting your device checked out. But otherwise, within your own home, anything under 1,000, you're definitely going to be okay. Short-term exposure to anything more than that, below 5,000, you're going to be okay there as well. Anything the doctor wants to add to that, more than happy to turn over to her.
Can I add a little something real quick?
Go for it.
Please. I've been very interested in this subject myself. Mm-hmm. We have a little CO2 monitor here, and we are right now with the windows were closed, but you saw Commissioner Dean get up because we were at nearly 1,200 in this. We are still, 6 people in our chambers. So we opened the window in response. And
it's freezing now.
Now it's. But if you look at the Jefferson County Chamber of Commerce's YouTube page, I brought a few people on there last year to do an hour long presentation on indoor air quality and ventilation. So you can get a lot of it, kind of dig into the German studies. And there's been a lot of great studies about this historically. So it would be a great option. And I saw it is posted on the chamber's YouTube page. And I'll pass it over to you, Dr. Berry.
You have been a proponent of good indoor air quality for quite some time, so I'm glad we're talking about it. And I'm glad this listener raised this question. So shy of about 1,000, we do think that that's really quite excellent indoor air quality. The ideal is to get it the same as outdoor. So, and it is going to be affected by your outdoor air quality. And so if you see if you take your monitor outside, that's as good as you're going to get of your indoor air quality. But in that 400 to 1,000 range, you're seeing pretty good air quality. And that's where you're going to reduce your risk of COVID-19 transmission, as well as your risk of multiple other infectious diseases that you could potentially spread. So that's good air quality there. Above 1,000 you're not really going to see risks related to the CO2 itself. It's not the CO2 that's causing the problem, but that stuffiness means that the air is staying there. So that means that your risk of viral transmission goes up, and your risk of any other toxic substances that might be in the air. So if you have, mold in that space, other things that could potentially cause problems, you're just kind of recirculating that air above 1,000. So it's not so much the CO2 that's going to hurt you at that point, but it's the other things that might be in the air, which is why you want good air quality. This person did mention that they had a measurement of 10,000. That is an industrial level dangerous. I think it's good to check the sensor first. If, however, you get a replacement sensor and you're still that high, that's considered dangerous for more than 8 hours at kind of the industrial level. We measure by work shifts when it comes to that. And so it's certainly not a place you want to spend 24/7. Common sources of CO2 that could get you that high in this person's in an accessory dwelling unit is if there's an attached garage and if there's a ventilation issue between the garage and your living space. Car engines can get you that high. And so if that turns out to be true, I would make sure if you're attached to a garage that you look at ventilation transfer between car spaces and living spaces and address that. Any kind of combustion can get you high. So if you have a wood burning stove, if you have a gas stove or a gas furnace, and there's poor ventilation that's getting some of that combusted air into your living space, that'd be another space that could get you into high levels. So look at various sources of combustion, whether it be cars or furnaces or stoves. And then of course, look at improving airflow. If you have access to windows, just opening those, or looking at any kind of HEPA filtration system can go a long way. So good luck, and thank you for the excellent public health question beyond the virus.
Great. And that we're a minute long, but I don't know, Willie, did you have anything else that you wanted to report on before we say goodbye to everyone and let the listeners get back to their scheduled programming?
Nothing else to report on. I did want to mention very, very quickly that today at noon, we will be testing. I'm doing our monthly test of the AHAB, the All Hazard Alert and Broadcast Sirens, mostly used for tsunami alerts, but they can be used for other things. Those are down at the boatyard at Point Wilson and at Point Hudson as well. So you can expect your monthly, the chimes, as well as the test message. I wanted to mention to folks that those are intended to be heard only by the folks outside in those areas, directly in the inundation zones. We get a lot of calls, a lot of emails on a regular basis kind of questioning, hey, I was, you know, inside, doing whatever, and I couldn't hear the message clearly. Just know that, especially if you were out of the tsunami inundation zone, not right there down by the shore, those sirens aren't intended to be messaged to you. So they're not intended to be heard indoors. It's no surprise that you couldn't hear it clearly. Just know that that's when we are testing them. So if you're outdoors, you should be able to expect to hear that message clearly and hear that regular test. I can go into more detail about our tsunami kind of alert and warning procedures, but since we're over, I just wanted to mention that. And if you have more questions, do feel free to reach out to us here at DEM.
All right. Well, let's just say you're priming the pump for next month.
There we go.
Hear more about that system when you return.
Perfect.
We'll give you some time again. We just, you know, we're used to, just the hello, goodbye. So we'll give you 10 minutes next month.
So thank you.
Okay. Great. If there's no last questions, we will turn the airwaves back over to KPT's regular programming. Thank you, Dr. Barry. Thank you, Willie. Good to see you guys.
See you next month.
Yep.